Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fucksters, what the fuckleberry fins, what the fuck nicks? I am Mark Maron. This is WTF. This is my show. Welcome to my show. Today on the show, the amazing Mick Foley. You might know him as Mankind. You might know him as Cactus Jack. You might know him as Dude Love. You might know him as the hardcore legend, Mrs. Foley's baby boy, Mick Foley, professional wrestler, Mick Foley. But now you might know him as Santa. That's right. Mick Foley is now known as Santa. We'll talk about that and other things. The amazing Mick Foley, good-hearted dude. Lot of life. Written books, been places, done things. Got a big heart and a busted-up body from that pro wrestling business. And as many of you know, I'm not a wrestling fan per se. I did not grow up enjoying the wrestling. I remember seeing the magazines. I've mentioned those magazines before, the pro wrestling magazines, just blood-spattered chubby dudes with bleach blonde hair and unitards, different positions of pain. I remember those magazines, but I did not watch the wrestling very much. I did not lock in, though I do have a relationship with some wrestlers who I enjoy as people, Mick Foley being one of them. Colt Cabana, who does a wonderful podcast with wrestlers, and CM Punk, who recently left the Worldwide Wrestling Federation, whatever it is, to much fanfare and aggravation. CM Punk left and is now heading towards the UFC. CM Punk just was acting in an episode of Marin last week. We did some work in the ring. So even though I may not be a fan of professional wrestling, I have been in the ring with the wrestler. And I have amplified my personality to the role of Mark Maron. Is that a wrestling role? Is it? Couldn't any of our roles in life be wrestling roles? Who's the face? Who's the heel in your life? Look around. What game? What script are you running? Pow! Look out. Just shit my pants. Just coffee.coop available at WTFpod.com. So I've been doing some comedy. Get my brain, you know, like I'm working out, like working out at the Comedy Store. Keeping in shape. Keeping that connection open because I am going to have to tour fairly quickly after I end shooting. Might be a surprise for those first few dates. Look, I think everything's pretty good. The shooting is going well. I went running yesterday. I think the world is not great, but it's holding up. It's raining a bit here in LA, which is always nice. Maybe that drought will go away. I've decided that a lot of what contributes to the drought outside of fracking and commercial farming and Beverly Hills mansions with large yards that they overwater. I think one of the primary causes that we don't talk about much in public for the Southern California drought is people masturbating in the shower. I mean, that can add anywhere from an extra, you know, 3 to 19 minutes, depending on your commitment. And that goes either way. You know, this is not just a dude thing. You know, believe me, ladies, I know about the glory of the shower massager. I'm no stranger to what you gals can do with the shower massager, or perhaps the spigot itself. That's right, I'm talking to you, ma'am. That's right, you spigot fuckers. I've known a couple of you. It's okay. I'm not judging. I'm not judging. But listen, I feel like I'm being a little callous. Let's open up the heart. The dating The girlfriend painter thing is going well. I am, you know, whatever shortcomings there are in my emotional capacity, given that I'm a cynical, angry fuck who's been through some things, I am not engaging in it. I've chosen detachment over rage because the rage is garbage. It has nothing, it has no place being dumped on other people. I was even on stage the other night, and a group of 12 walked in. This was Saturday night at the Comedy Store, and I was sitting there with Sarah watching 12 people walk into a packed house and said, they're their own audience, and they're going to be trouble. You get that many people together, you get them having a good time, that's how people die sometimes, and it's at least how comics have a bad night. And I got on stage, third up, person before me, Steve Trevino, addressed the fact that they were yammering, gabbing away. And I got up there and I felt it. I felt the tug of their rudeness. And a lot of times that's just like bait for my angry heart to just dump a lifetime's worth of infantile garbage onto an unsuspecting stranger who is asking for it in my demented brain in that moment because they are interrupting my dumb jokes. And I'd much rather try to annihilate a stranger mentally and in public in front of people they don't know than do my jokes. My heart would rather do that. I personally would rather do the jokes and have a nice experience. So in that moment, I said to that person, I said, there's nothing more I'd rather do than to humiliate you and to start a lot of shit, probably use words that would make people uncomfortable and maybe even turn the audience against me. There was a time I said to this woman and this gentleman and whoever the fuck was talking, there was a time where I would do that. I would take up my entire set to do that. I would ruin the next two comics' acts to do that. But not tonight. Not tonight. I'm just going to tell you that it's rude what you're doing. I don't like you as people because you don't know how to behave in an audience situation. And you're being selfish. And I'd like you to be quiet so I can get through my set. And I'd like you to be quiet for the rest of the show because it's just it's horrible behavior and you're bad people. Calmly said that. And felt good about it. I felt that that was a diplomatic way to handle it, as opposed to like, what the fuck is your problem? Were you not parented properly, you dumb fucks? As opposed to that, I just told them I didn't like them and they were rude adults and didn't know how to behave themselves. Was not satisfying as the other way, but that's what I did. Proud of myself. So the anger is being stifled, but I don't know. It's got to be coming out somewhere. I think it's manifesting itself in man boobs from the amount of food I'm eating. But maybe I'm the only one seeing those. I can't even believe I just said man boobs. I don't have man boobs. Oh, God, fuck. And yeah, but, dating somebody who has their own art. I mean, this woman has a painting hanging in LACMA. Her name is Sarah Kane. I will give you her name now. I will try to do that because I feel like I've been like hiding parts of my life and I've been running low on things that I could talk about. She's a lovely woman. She manages a small cat farm at her house. She enjoys tea. She doesn't eat the meat and she's a brilliant abstract painter. And I am intimidated by her grand paintings. I look at the work she does and I was brought up to respect artists, especially painters, man, painters. That is some fuck. This chick has balls, man. She's got an axe, you know, an axe in that brush. And it's all very, it's intimidating. Like her paintings make me feel small. It's like, well, I said this thing last night. Really, I spent 4 hours a day on this line. I made two moves. I added that black and I put that gold in. And I'm standing there going like, holy fuck. That's amazing, and that's going to last forever. I diplomatically diminished some hecklers last night. I was very proud of myself in that moment. Yeah, I'm starting a new canvas tomorrow. Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm probably going to talk. I'm going to creatively complain for laughs a little bit tomorrow. Not complaining. Everything's copacetic. Doing good. Doing good. Can you hear the edge? You can hear it, right? So listen up. Marination tours, shows have been added in Seattle. Show will be added by Wednesday this week in Toronto. Show has been added in Boston, Massachusetts. Vancouver, spread the word, would you? Need a little, need to push that baby up there. I know it's months away, but let's try to sell these tickets. San Francisco, Rochester, New York at the Comedy Club, Friday, March 20th and Saturday, March 21st. The Warner Theater. The Warner Theater in D.C., April 9th, April 10th, the Trocadero, two shows in Philly. April 11th, the Wilbur Theater in Boston, two shows. April 16th, the Barrymore Theater, Madison, Wisconsin. Get your tickets. They're running. It's happening. April 17th, Carnegie of Homestead Music Hall in Pittsburgh. Beautiful posters for these. April 18th, Royal Oak Music Theater in Royal Oak, Michigan. Get the tickets. April 19th, Bluma Appel in Toronto, adding a second show. April 23rd, the Paramount Theater in Austin, Texas. Let's do that. That's at the Moon Tower Festival. I'd love to see you. April 25th, Fitzgerald in Houston. Few tickets left. Fitzgerald's. April 26th, Southside Music Hall in Dallas. Get some tickets for that, Dallas. You know, I don't know how I do in Texas and outside of Austin. May 8th, the Neptune, Seattle, Washington. And May 8th, the Neptune Late Show. Two shows. May 9th, the Vogue in Vancouver. Do you not get my podcast in Vancouver? Let's go, Vancouver. What, are you waiting until the last week? It's looking good. I've sold a few hundred, but that's a big place, man. May 10th, Davis Symphony Hall in San Francisco. Again, I've sold like 1,000, but I need 1,000 more. Come on. Come on. May 14th, the Orange Peel in Asheville, North Carolina. And May 15th at the Charleston Music Hall in Charleston, South Carolina. May 16th, Variety Playhouse, Atlanta. Come on, Atlanta. Enjoy theater on May 17th in New Orleans. Do you not get my show in New Orleans? A few hundred sold. Let's keep it going. You can wait if you want. Here's what I want to tell you. So I'm probably going to be shaving my face entirely for the last show. I got to shoot some stuff that requires that. So it might be a little jarring in Rochester to see a shaven face. You're going to see my face. Some of you will see my face. I will see my face. Let's see how it's doing under there. No affectation. No caffeine, no nicotine, no alcohol, no drugs. Cut down the sugar and I'm going to remove my facial hair. I will be naked. Naked! Man boobs. Don't want them. So look, folks, I'm going to bring to you now the Mick Foley conversation. The lovely Mick Foley. Mankind! And we aired part of this conversation back in November on episode 552 when Mick's documentary, I Am Santa Claus, came out. You can watch that on Netflix. Right now, Mick is on tour with the one-man show that you'll hear us talk about. Go to realmickfoley.com to check out his tour schedule and get tickets. Mick Foley, hero.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Let's talk to him. Do you remember your childhood not fondly otherwise?
There were some rough patches. Life was not always easy on a heavy set kid.
Where'd you grow up?
Long Island. Yeah.
That's right. I remember. It's all coming back to me because we had done some stuff on Air America. You came down. When you were working for that foundation, right? And we were talking about books, and there was the abused women.
Yeah, Rain. Yeah, Rain. Yeah. I was doing a lot of work for Rain at the time. I was an active volunteer for 2 years for Rain. Nice acronym, tough words: rape, abuse, incest, national network. So I was like an advocate. And I was a donor, and then I took the 40-hour online course, and then I did like the 20-hour in-person training. And
for what exactly?
This is I would
to be a
like,
spokesperson.
No, I would be when people needed help.
Oh,
and
really?
They would reach out. I mean, if someone is listening and they need help or know someone needs help, I mean, the website is really simple. It's Rain, R A I NN.org.
And you still do that?
No, I did it for 2 years, and it was tough, man.
But
it
if someone called you with those kind of issues, you could...
They would do it online, and then I would be an anonymous, you know, I had a different name. They wouldn't say, hey, Mick Foley. I would have a different name, and I was good at it.
Like, what compelled you to do something like that? Being like, obviously you've got a big heart, but I mean, you know, the characters you've played, in the ring and sort of what wrestling represents, which is, it doesn't represent anything but wrestling, but you know, it's sort of like, you wouldn't think that you would end up, as an online helper for rape and incest and abusive relationship.
The key was, I met Tori Amos at Comic-Con 2008.
And she did it?
I was a huge fan, and I don't know. I described it in my book. I said, when I finally met her, and she stood up from her table, and my first words were not, they were in a question, they were, I can hug you? And then she gave me the biggest hug, and I don't know if she transferred some energy like John Coffey did in The Green Mile, but... Yeah. Yeah, I felt like a changed man, and I'd never been on the internet in my life.
The man who was mankind hugs Tori Amos, and everything changes.
Everything changed. Everything changed.
With one Tori Amos hug.
Oh, the power of the Tori Amos hug, yeah.
Oh, my God. It just placated. It rested the beast.
It seemed to do something, and when I wandered over, like, I'd had my kids put me on a website. I could say, I want to see something. Can you get me on there?
Yeah.
But I'd never actually, like, ventured on there myself, and then I found a way to go on ToriAmos.com. Honestly, I wanted to see if she had put a photo of the two of us.
Hugging?
No, or otherwise. You know, we did the posed photos, too. Mm-hmm. And it turned out somebody actually did snap a photo. I mean, I remember, if you don't mind me going off on this Tori Amos tangent.
I think it's a wonderful thing to know about you, Mick.
I looked at her after the hug and I said, you know who I am? I'll never forget it as long as I live. Like, she moved her hands like in majestic arcs, almost like she was Mr. Miyagi saying wax on, wax off, except with far more pageantry and elegance. And she said, I know exactly who you are.
Oh my God.
It turned out that her nephew was like a big fan, and he had told her about this wrestler who would mention her I'd written a few books. And Tori would make occasional, I'd make occasional Tori Amos references. Uh-huh. So it was cool. I don't know. You know, I mean, she just.
Did you feel it was deeper than that, though? When she said, I know exactly who you are, did you feel like, oh my God, my soul is exposed?
Something like that. Yeah. She could read me. And I was. You know what? I'm going to have breaking news for you here. This is. I don't know if I don't know if she wants me to tell this story. I got news from a third person. Mentioned my name, and this was somebody who was close to Tori and was a mutual friend.
Yeah.
And after she met with her, she said, Tori called her back in the room and said, tell Mick he's done enough. Like, she really? She wanted me to stop giving. She thought I was giving too much money. She knew I was doing benefits. And
for Rain?
Yeah. And she's like, he's done enough.
Oh,
he
wow.
He needs to take care of himself and his family. And it was like, it was like, okay. It's almost like, you know, a fighter has someone throw in the towel photo.
Yeah.
So I didn't quit. Somebody let me down, you know.
The ref called it.
Yeah. She called it.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Did you stop?
For a while. Right now, I'm raising money for a Santa whose house burned down.
Save the Santa campaign?
I'm calling it Sockos for Santa. I'm selling autographed socks because that was
the
one
Mankind
puppet. There you go. You know your
Mankind
stuff, Mark.
Sock puppet. I don't know much.
All right, but I knew you know that. That was like part of the...
I knew that was part of the gift, the Mankind get up.
It was. And so when I go out there before a show and I say, hey, I've got these things for sale, and there's one of Santa's ambassadors, you know, is on tough times, house burned down, lost everything, every photo, everything, and we're going to try to make a little difference. So every night I'll go to the GoFundMe.
Yeah.
So I'm not tempted to keep it.
And yeah,
every
yeah,
night
yeah.
I make the donation, but I think she'll understand. I got to do something.
Well, so you've got this part of you that feels compelled to help out Santas and to help out women in trouble. And I mean, you grew up in Long Island. What town?
This was like Stony Brook by the university there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So, like, how many kids in the family?
Just me and my brother.
And where'd he end up?
He's, he works for UPS. You know, like, on not on the driving side.
on the
he
other
doesn't
side?
Wear the shorts.
No.
He's in one of the guys.
Was he ever a shorts guy?
Yeah. To be in UPS, you have to be a shorts guy for a while. You have to.
That's your
initiation? You have to know how to walk the walk, yeah.
In the shorts.
Yes, in the long shorts.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And now he's on the other side?
He's on the other
side. He's behind the desk?
Yeah.
You don't need to wear shorts behind the
barking
desk.
Barking out orders.
Yeah, you don't have to wear any pants behind the desk. And your folks, and like, what was the home? What's your old man do?
My dad was passed away a few years ago, but he was really highly thought of. He's the athletic director at our high school, and for five elementary schools, two
really?
Junior highs, and 2,500 student high school. So my dad was so highly thought of that when he passed away, they lowered the flags at all. At every one of the district schools, all eight schools. And when we drove by out of the funeral home, I mean, I swear, it was very touching. It was right across the street from the high school. They had the flag at half-mast. And they had a member of every one of the fall teams, like, outside. It was, I'm getting goosebumps thinking about it now. So, you know, my dad, I said in my first book, like, you know, I was known as a guy who worked really, really, you know, really hard, gave people their money's worth. And especially, you know, when that camera light was on, you know, I was going to dig down a little deeper, and I said, my dad, he worked every day like the camera light was on. So, yeah, he touched a lot of lives, and I think that's, you know, something he passed on to me.
Yeah, it seems like it. So he seemed like a great guy.
Yeah.
Did he push you athletically?
He did, yeah, and we had a tough patch there. I mean, it seems crazy now, and especially as I've had long hair, give or take a couple of shaved heads since 1985.
You gotta like, shave your head occasionally, mix it up.
Well, when I got out of wrestling in 2000, yeah. I celebrated my birthday at Hershey Park. I did a Q&A, and they traded it out for like 3 days at the park.
Right.
And free, they lost out, free food and lodging. And then I went back after the Q&A, shaved off all my hair, been long for 15 years.
Yeah.
And the next day, like I went down to the hotel, and they said, "How are you doing, Mr. Foley?" I was like, How do you know I am? Like, and it turns out like I've got a prominent injury. Well, I lost one of my ears along the way, and without the hair, it made me very detectable, very easily.
You're missing an ear.
I am, yeah. So you know, the young lady lost her lost her ear, a part of it at a UFC fight. Did you know that?
No,
it was hideous, and I started getting these messages. So I just reached out to her
and said, her the, it welcome
gets,
to the club.
It gets better. It gets better. And like the next day, like she reached out to me and thanked me for being there. And it was like one of these feel good worlds collide.
Did you email Tori Amos and tell her about that?
I didn't include Tori. I didn't know if Tori needed to be part of this. Yeah,
I'm helping the earless now. Anybody with one ear, I'm raising some money.
We're going to get together for a support group. It's and Hollyfield.
We're going to try and get some new ears for some people. So you got the shaving the head didn't hide you, man.
Didn't hide me. And then like 2 days later, Mr. McMahon, the owner of WWE, called me up and he was like,
hey, is that what you call him?
I called him Vince. Until about 3 years ago, when I kind of lost my touch, you know, I left and I worked for not that there is any competition to WWE, but I definitely worked for someone else other than them. And then I never quite found my mojo around him when I got back.
And no more Vince.
And now he's Mr. McMahon. Yeah.
Weird.
Yeah, very strange.
Did that just happen organically?
It did. Yeah, it seemed to. I felt like I was kind of like the boy who cried wolf and betrayed him simultaneously. Yeah.
Do you feel guilty about that?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. But I told his... His daughter, Stephanie, who I've known, she was, 19, 20 years old. I said, I think I had to leave in order to better appreciate just how well everything is done here.
Like, oh, really?
It's...
Were you like part of the family, I imagine?
I was like part of the family.
How long were you with them?
I was with them off and on for, I started there in 96. And, off and on, I felt like I was Dorothy who had given the ability, even after I retired from full-time wrestling in 2000, like I had the ability to like tiptoe back and forth from Kansas to Oz, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I could lead this normal life. And then anytime I wanted, I could call up the company and say, hey, can I appear? I did that when I do the one-man show, and so I was traveling around the UK and Ireland, because you have to make that distinction. Don't ever don't ever include Ireland on your UK tour.
Did that once.
That's the last time you ever make that mistake, right?
Yeah.
So you got to say UK
set.
And Ireland, yeah. Right? And I was in Dublin. I got there a day early, and WWE happened to be there. So I called up. I was like, hey, I hadn't been on a show in 3 years. I was like, can I show up? And they were like, sure. So I was like, hey, ladies and gentlemen, surprise. And as much as I love, and I really do get almost everything I used to get, you know, from doing the shows in front of a couple hundred people as opposed to, 10 or 15,000 people.
Yeah.
But it's kind of cool to know that if you want that 15,000 reaction without having any pressure to perform,
just to
any
walk
pressure
out?
To bring the crowd in. It's almost like the difference between, cooking a dinner and cleaning it up when you're done and just walking out and enjoying the meal. So,
it's a little bigger than that because, if you're in a pinch, if you're feeling a little low and there's a WWE fight around, you can be like, I'm just going to go wave, get some juice.
And that was how simple it was. And Vince even said, he goes, Mick, after all you've done, I want you to consider WWE to be your playground, and you can come back and play anytime you want. And I did that for many years.
Yeah. In and out.
In and out.
You get a few bucks?
They would take it. That was not the, I didn't, they would, they always took care of me.
But you're physically incapable of wrestling.
I cannot wrestle anymore, yeah. That was a decision. A neurologist arrived at that conclusion.
With what did he say?
He said, you're done. And
what was the tipper?
WWE, this credit to them, is they started giving these impact tests to measure the repercussions of brain injuries. And even as I was doing the test, I realized it wasn't going well, especially as far as the short-term memory went. And so independent of WWE, I called a top neurologist I knew at the Boston Center for Traumatic Encephalopathy. And as long as I could say those words, I know I'm doing pretty good.
Yeah.
And made an appointment. And then that day later, one day later, WWE called me and they said, there's been an issue with your impact test. And so independently of each other, both of these neurologists came to the conclusion that I was done.
Because of your brain?
Yeah, just too many injuries. And one of the things we learn as we go, which I didn't know, is at the time, because everyone thinks they're unstoppable when they're at their peak. But that as you get older, and I would, on one level, I realized I was getting hurt quicker. Yeah. It didn't take as much to hurt me, and it lasted longer. But then there was also that sense that I don't feel that bad. And I realized that, I was pretty lucky to have a good job and a tough economy. It didn't call for me to do that much. It was like, I can take a few more of these. And so it really did. I mean, every wrestler's convinced they've got another match left in them. And so I was lucky, fortunate, as it turns out, to have a neurologist, again, almost like Tori Amos with the funding, just throwing in the towel and saying, you've done enough. You've done too much.
You got a doctor's note addressed directly to your bad side.
Exactly.
But how did you hobble yourself? What's with the...
Oh, yeah, you noticed that as I was walking, right?
I think last time... the last time we talked was 2004, so it's been 10 years.
Yeah, yeah.
So you were out of the racket 4 years.
And I was moving around okay,
Yeah.
And I'd dropped some weight. It was kind of Mother Nature.
Yeah.
And Father Time teaming up to kick my ass a little bit, Mark, telling me I wasn't as tough as I thought I was.
But you were all in, guy. I guess the reason why you were such a phenomenal a performer in that is that you would take risks, right?
I did. I didn't consider them risks. I consider myself to be high impact as far as high risk. I knew when I was doing things, there's going to be a price to pay.
High impact means you could take a beating.
I could take a beating. I could, even as, everyone had their idea of what wrestling was. And on my one-man show, I elaborate on this a little bit, but I actually had a formula in my head. I thought, if I do things that hurt me enough, people will think they hurt me a little.
Right.
Because I was a fan who liked to figure out how moves were done and how the aura of danger was created without putting the wrestler's body too much risk.
Yeah.
But the things I was really fascinated by were the moves I couldn't figure out. Like, I'd watch them over and over. I don't know how they do
Who
that.
Who did those?
Oh, there was a lot of that you'd see in Japan, and Jimmy Superfly Snuka with the Superfly Splash. Terry Funk with an N. We're not dealing with the FCC here, but just to be clear, Terry Funk with an N. And I would try to figure out how these guys
So it was like magic.
Well, it wasn't magic. It would be like when you watch, what's the one with, there were two great magic movies out, the Prestige.
Yeah.
Right, and then you find out the way they do the dove, you know, the dove is actually killed.
Right.
And they bring, like,
that's it. That you got to beat the shit out of yourself.
Yeah, exactly. So it wasn't a magic trick at all.
He was actually getting hurt.
And when I was 19, and I thought that seemed like a pretty good idea, like, everything I do will cause people to look at each other and go, oh, that had to hurt. It looks like after 30 years, like, the secret is, you were right.
It did.
You were right.
It did hurt.
Yeah, it did hurt.
So wait, let's get back to your dad and what seemed to be a long hair problem.
Oh, yeah, yeah. 1981, when your dad's the athletic director, it seems ridiculous now because hairstyles have changed so much. I used to get knocked, like, in the late 70s. I remember a girl coming up to me and singing, "Square ain't got no hair," because I was the only guy in the school. I'm talking about in the school with a crew cut.
He made you have a crew cut?
He didn't make me.
Understood?
I liked it. You know, mm-hmm. I liked it, and I guess in that sense, I liked being different.
Yeah.
Probably if everyone had their hair long, I would not. I'd find a different way. And even with the short hair, you know, being out, like a mohawk in 1982 was like almost unheard of. So when I showed up with a mohawk, because I was on the school wrestling team with Kevin James.
Oh, he's funny,
high school teammate, yeah.
Was he funny then?
He was funny, but he was mostly, like, tough.
Yeah.
You know, like, people forget. Now that he's done the UFC movie, you know, people are, okay, you know, you can see.
Well, he looks
see
like a wrestler.
Deltoids, you
know? Yeah, yeah.
He was one of two guys in school who could bench 300 pounds, and in case you're wondering, I was not the other one.
He's that guy.
Yeah,
huh?
He
that
was
makes
that
sense.
Guy.
That and, makes sense.
To this day, I felt, I feel like going out for that team, knowing that he was already, like, penciling in as a heavyweight, was like the boldest, gutsiest move that I had ever made. And if somebody had stopped me, like, on my way down to the wrestling room and said, "You know Kevin James down there," if I'd thought about it, I probably would have said, "I'm out of here."
Really? He was a badass, huh?
Yeah, I mean, he was the guy you didn't mess with.
You stay in touch?
We did for many years.
Yeah.
For many years. And then the last time I saw him, I was a surprise guest on Katie Couric's show.
Uh-huh.
And
like, "This Is Your Life"
kind
of thing?
"This Is Your Life." It was, you know, Grown Ups 2, and so the theme was they were surprising people, surprising the cast with guests from their past. So it was Adam Sandler's basketball coach.
Oh, right,
and,
right.
And then I came in as the guest from Kevin's past. So we got to catch up for 10 minutes while we sat there, because I was like, the surprise guest. I didn't see him before.
Was he happy to see you?
He acted like it. Yeah, he was, you know. I know one time when they surprised him with a Mick Foley contribution. I think he was promoting The Zookeeper.
Yeah.
And they're like, "We have a guest from your past via video." And he was like, "Oh, Mick Foley." Like, he knew it was coming. He knew it was coming. But he certainly, he was a good dude, man. We used to hang out, not only in high school. He transferred to my college, and we did some road trips and listened to some Springsteen. Back in 1986.
Yeah, you and him just in the car, Born to Run.
In the USA by this time.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Then you didn't go back? It was just the new
stuff?
Well,
of course you'd go back. Yeah, I guess you would. You know? I just heard Candy's Room yesterday.
It's good, right?
Yeah, they were playing the entire...
Darkness.
And you know what? Now that we're on Springsteen, I'm not saying it wasn't a great album.
It's a great album.
How did it get so big among, like, high schoolers? Because it's pretty depressing.
Well, that record, I think, is that after Born to Run or
before?
It was just after Born to Run. So I think he grabbed everybody with the spirit of Born to Run. And then I think he spent like 2 or 3 years on Darkness.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like, that was the epic. I mean, the journey got a little darker for him after Born to Run. Born to Run's like almost romantic. You know what I mean? Like, it's passionate. There's a sort of a, you know, go get it kind of embrace the American dream with all your creative spirit. And then it got a little dark. Stayed a little dark for a while.
And when he ends with Darkness on the Edge of Town, it's almost like you're left feeling like, oh, there's no hope whatsoever.
I know, but Bruce is so elevated about it. He's very passionate. You know, there's something about, there's always hope in his voice. Have you ever met him?
I did. Yeah, I did meet Bruce a couple times. Actually, if you go through like the last 10 years of photos.
Yeah.
There is a very good chance I'll be wearing a vest that says Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band, Stockholm, Sweden, like 1993. And it was given to me by one of Bruce's best friends, Terry McGovern.
Yeah.
And I wore the vest for two very good reasons. One, I was a big Bruce fan. I love the fact that Terry had given to me his gift. And the second reason was when the fanny pack went out, mm-hmm. like in 2000, before I brought it roaring back to life six yeah. months ago, when I realized I was committed.
Is that why everyone's wearing them? I was wondering. It's all you, Mick.
I realized, I looked at it, this is the truth. I looked at a segment WWE had on their network, and I realized I committed so many fashion errors in a 10-minute segment. And I just looked at my kids, and I was like, why don't I just start wearing the fanny pack? But up yeah. until then, the Terry McGovern Springsteen vest, it had zippers on the pockets.
Yeah.
And I was like a kangaroo. Without it was my pack.
It was for practical reasons.
Practical reasons, and also emotionally. I felt very tied to it.
Well, what did Bruce say to you when you met Bruce?
Bruce always very soft, very soft spoken. He was always very cordial.
Yeah.
But I would be a great stretch for me to say that he was
a pal. Yeah, just sort of in passing.
I will say that Nils Lofgren came to my show in Phoenix.
Oh,
and
yeah?
And he played.
Does he live there?
He does, yeah.
I got that box set. I got to dig into that,
Nils,
man.
Nils is awesome. And he actually, I was surprised. One day, WWE announcer Michael Cole sent me over an email and had Nils doing like an impromptu song when I was inducted into the Hall of Fame, And I'd always, to this day, I swear that like the live version of Youngstown in Madison Square Garden is the coolest guitar solo I've ever heard.
Yeah.
I was there at the time. Now, I can't tell you, he did 10 nights at the Garden.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure which night it was,
right.
But I just remember like my friend Scott Darrow, friends in seventh grade, he goes, Nils is going off. Like we were aware that
something was happening.
Historic. And then when the when the DVD came out and the CD, I was just mesmerized by it. Just thought it was powerful. Really, really loved it.
So like with your father, going back, you guys were tense for how long?
Maybe just those couple of high school years, And then as time went by, we became very close, and he was very close with my children.
Did he appreciate the wrestling?
Yeah, he did. He did. You would think he would not, but he did.
Did you have to explain it to him?
No, and here's the thing. Even though my dad was like the real sports guy, and I grew up, with my childhood, this is a weird thing. Like, I fondly remember, the scent of B.O.
Yeah.
That was like a good thing. Like
the even locker if we room
went
kind
to,
deal?
Yeah, we went to a cross country meet.
Yeah.
And that wasn't my favorite. That was a basketball, baseball, football, wrestling.
You did everything, though? You had to do everything?
I had to go to every event.
Oh.
Women's field, everything, but like that was like a
why, because you were with him?
That was how we spent time. My dad worked a lot, so
where are you going? We're taking a road trip.
Yeah, we'd go everywhere.
Watch some field
and
hockey.
And then during the basketball games, the coolest thing was he'd give us the key to the weight room.
Yeah.
And at that time, lifting weights for fun seemed cool.
Yeah,
did after,
And he had to maintain your physique.
Yeah, right. I always just did it because I had to, not because I enjoyed it at all. But it was really wrestling that brought us back together. And I know this sounds funny with a non-fan, but there's something multi-generational about it. I mean, I'm not exaggerating when I tell you thousands of people have said, I used to watch it. They always include the grandfather, the father, the uncle. And in so many cases, there are people, relatives who are having a tough time everywhere else. And this was specific to Mike, I'm talking about my case specifically, but in general, it's safe to say that, it's for a lot of people, it's the one thing they feel more comfortable watching with company than alone.
Because it's a good time.
Yeah, let's watch some wrestling. And my dad could appreciate the
I think they know that it's a controlled environment.
That's almost what it is.
Yeah.
It's like these guys are putting on a show for our enjoyment. Yeah, and it all seems kind of safe that way.
Yeah. So he was on board the whole way.
He was very supportive of me when I started out, even when the money wasn't exactly piling up. And I came home from Nigeria in 1987 after I'd literally been bludgeoned by by fans. Turns out that not everyone in the world knows it's entertainment. And if you cheat in Nigeria against the Nigerian champion, Power Udi, some people will take it the wrong way. And Yeah,
even though it was a script.
Well, they but you have, in this case, you know, one of the few times that I wrestled in front of more than the a few hundred people, about 30,000 people in this stadium in 1987. Yeah, and I hit Power Udi with some type of fart. It was actually a large like cow's bone, like a thigh bone. And next thing I know, I'm just being pummeled by fans.
Jesus
and,
Christ.
The wrestlers dragged me out of there, and I was stitched up in a chemist's office with a dirt floor because they told me not to trust the hospital.
Because they might have...
Well, I don't know what they...
What
just,
that
no,
means.
No, the chemist's office. So, yeah, the wrestlers, I mean, I feel like they saved my life over there. And when I got home, with like $300 for the 2 weeks... After being, having a life threatening experience, my dad was like, "Hey, not everyone can say they went to Nigeria." he was always like, "Think glass half full." Great experience, Mick. And I couldn't appreciate it at the time.
So when you retired, though, were you set? I mean, was that a choice? Like you were like, "I got enough bread to go."
Well, I was pretty. I say pretty thrifty.
Yeah.
Some people would say extremely thrifty.
Yeah.
On the road. And I had saved a lot of money, and I'd been there when times were really good.
Yeah.
I didn't know that the economy was going to tank a couple of times.
Yeah.
So it was almost like, and then I didn't know that the world was going to line up at my door to read my novels.
Right.
And after the second novel, it was actually after the first.
A lot of goodwill out there for you.
A lot of goodwill.
Yeah.
But it didn't mean that they were going to follow me on that journey. Just
right.
Like, The show I do is, by and large, it's like a wrestling-centric storytelling show. I've been at it for 5 years. It's taking people a long time to figure out that it's a wrestling show. Like when I show up, does anyone have any idea what I do?
Most people sometimes don't. You go to a cold room?
No, they're really receptive. And I'll go out on a limb and say I greatly outperform their limited expectations.
Well, let's see. So you did four novels.
Two novels. Four memoirs.
Yeah,
and
memoirs.
That sounds horrible.
Yeah.
There's like reason.
So six books.
And then four kids' books.
And how those go?
Kids' books were good.
Yeah.
The first two sold really well. The last two didn't, but they were like the better books,
Yeah.
And so there's a moral lesson. Especially with the novels, it was the same thing, I'll tell you what happened. Kevin Smith came to our premiere in L.A. for I Am Santa Claus. And we did his podcast after the show. And he explained that he and his wife don't go to the movies. They went out of their way to see this. And it was really gratifying to have a guy who knew movies telling me why it was good.
Yeah.
So me and the director, and I said, "Kevin, you just made me critic proof." He goes, "Dude, you haven't seen my reviews." I said, not that. I said, "But from now on, it doesn't matter if I get a horrible review because my answer internally will be, Kevin Smith liked it.
He knows
more about knows more about movies than you."
Yeah.
When it came to novels, it was Richard Price, who's did Clockers and, most of the writing for The Wire, the first two seasons, really like a writer's writer.
Yeah.
And he read it beforehand. He was one of my
the first novel.
He read the second one.
Yeah.
And then I got a call back. I asked my my editor, Victoria Wilson, who had edited for Nobel Prize winners, if I, instead of her sending letters to writers that she knew,
mm-hmm.
if I could maybe send letters to writers whose work I like, thinking they might like mine. And I remember saying, "Darling, you can do whatever you like, but don't expect anything from this." And at that time, everything was handwritten. So
yeah.
I wrote 12, 12 letters.
To who?
Jonathan Kellerman and Stephen King and John Irving and Richard Price.
Uh-huh.
And then one day, she read them. She said, "Darling, these are very charming.
Yeah.
Don't get your hopes up." And
yeah.
then I'm at my home one night. I get a phone call before, 2004 was like before texting and tweeting.
Sure.
And it was Richard Price.
Yeah.
And he was like, "I'm really enjoying this novel and I'm going to give you a great blurb when I'm done. And maybe someday we can get together and trade stories." I said, "Okay, about what?" He said, "About growing up in the Bronx," because my book was set in the Bronx in the 60s. I said, "I didn't grow up in the Bronx." And so here's Richard Reisman nominated for a National Book Award and an Academy Award. He goes, "You must have really done your homework."
Yeah.
And I said, "Well, come from you, Mr. Price. That's a great honor." And he ended up writing me a blurb that was actually better written than anything I could ever write. It was so profound. And it clearly wasn't not to pick on Larry King, but it wasn't just
right.
"He does it again. No one does it."
Yeah. Like
Camille.
Yeah.
clearly he had read the book and had this great quote. And from that point on, whereas I took the criticism for the first novel to heart, you know, let it get to me, like I was very realistic about the sales and knew that I would take a beating from a few critics here or there, even though overall people, you know, critics are very kind to both my novels. But when those bad ones did come, it was like, Richard Price likes my books.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He knows more about writing than you
did
do.
Did Stephen King get back to you?
Stephen King did not, but I did get, at that time, my publisher said, I think I know the answer to this question, but would you mind if we gave John Irving your address? I was like, no, I don't mind if you give John Irving my address. And I swear, I felt like Charlie Bucket, you know, when he gets that golden ticket home and there's J. Irving, you know.
He wrote you?
He wrote me. And so, and he was like, he was explaining why he couldn't get to the book. He said he read my first novel, enjoyed it, and then he kind of gave a very descriptive.
He's a wrestling guy.
He is a wrestling guy. And he wrote to me how he dislocated his finger graphically, and then he said, thought you might enjoy it given your background. So I wrote him back, said, Dear Mr. Irving, thank you very much for taking the time to write to me. Don't worry about, you know, not having the time. I said, one of my fears is that one day I'll be a real writer and people I don't know will be sending books to me, ask if I'll review them. And like a week later, I get a book, Dear Mr. Foley, please don't concern yourself with whether or not you're a real writer. He said, those who would classify writers as either literary or commercial can be counted on to be neither. And then he told a story about how, a critic saw him having lunch with Stephen King and later expressed surprise, and he said, you know, Stephen and I have more in common than you might think. Neither one of us would even, you know, would begin a project unless we were sure we could shock or offend somebody. And it began this nice, like, and I swear I would look at that blank page and I would be so nervous because I knew without my editor putting in the semicolons, the hyphens in the right place, like, I'm just this wrestling dude, you know, with a pen.
But did you go into wrestling, right? You went to college, right?
I went to college, and that was, I started breaking into pro wrestling when I was 19, when I was a sophomore in college. And my
Where'd
dad's
you go?
Cortland, New York.
Yeah.
Cortland, New York. And I was actually born in Bloomington, Indiana. I see you've got the Bloomington shirt there.
Yeah, I like Bloomington.
And you've been there to the comedy attic, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a nice little room.
It's a cool
Jared's
room.
A good guy.
Yeah, he is a good guy.
Yeah, he's a believer. Believer in comedy.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I loved it. And it's been really cool for me.
How long were you lived there, though, for?
Oh, just a little while.
Right. You
know, my dad was studying for his doctorate there.
Oh, yeah? That's where you got his degree? Yeah, it's a hell of a school, that place.
Yeah.
It's kind of cool.
So I grew up as a big IU fan.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. You know, was in tears when they were down by
But what'd you study?
I studied communications.
So you really didn't have a background in English or anything?
No, but looking back on it, like when I took English in college, like I remember finding my, you know, papers years later.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you know, 15 years later. And one of the professors had said, you should really consider this for a career. And at the time, you know, that sounded
had a good feel for it.
Ridiculous.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I, when I went back and look at stuff I wrote as like a 6 or 7 year old, it was pretty good.
Now, when you look back, like, you know, in talking about, you know, your charity work or your causes, I mean, do you ever, when you look at the sort of damage that wrestling does to guys and that a lot of guys didn't fare as well as you, even though you're a little beat up, you know, mentally and emotionally, you seem to have a pretty good spirit. I mean, it seems like there's a lot of dudes that didn't fare as well. I mean, do you know, how do you feel about them? Have you ever been put in a position to help some of your comrades out?
Yeah. When people ask me what I'm proudest, you know, there's some things I'm proud of. I'm the only WWE champion that I know of that doesn't actually have the physical championship belt that he won. And when my kids, you know, younger kids, and now they're big fans, they're like, Dad, why don't you have the belt?
Yeah.
And it's like they kind of know, but I haven't, like, but I basically put it up for auction to help a wrestler pay his medical bills. So I, you know, like, I look back, like, I wish I had the belt, but I like what not having it represents.
Yeah.
You know, like, I've got this thing that reminds me of my career. Like, I don't need something on a wall. I've got this thing called waking up. that reminds me. Yeah, and yeah. So like when given the choice again, I don't know if I would give that up. I'd probably have it mounted in a special place. But I, like I said, I'm proud of what not having it represents.
How'd the guy do?
He got out of the hospital. Yeah. It's a tough way to make a living. It's a tough way.
But you didn't get strung out or nothing. You were never a drug guy?
No, I was never a drug guy at all. And as a matter of fact, like when I was in the late 80s, early 1990s, when I was wrestling with Ted Turner's World Championship Wrestling, you know, and I, like the character I had was that of like a psychologically deranged man. But among the guys, like the thing that made them like suspend disbelief was the idea that he doesn't smoke pot.
Yeah.
He must be crazy. Because at the time, I mean, let's face it, that's a harmless, fairly harmless thing.
Yeah.
But I avoided it because I knew that I'd like it if I ever tried it. So I never even tried it.
Well, I think you got off on taking risks.
maybe so. And I also realized at a young age, you know, at age 19, that this was going to be a style that had consequences, and that I was realistic enough to know that don't medicate, you know, unless you really, really need it. And there are some nights, you know, days when I really, really need something, and then I'll take it. But like, I have to get my refill every 6 months because it's expired and I've only taken 3 pills in 6 months. So I was always pretty good that way.
And when did you decide to start doing a live show?
Oh, man.
Because I know it's been going on a while.
Yeah.
Has it evolved?
Yeah, it's really, it's, you know what? Montreal.
You do comedy clubs.
Yeah, I do comedy clubs. So it's funny because people say, oh, so you do stand up. And I kind of wince. And there's nothing to do with the respect I have for comics, because when other comics see me and go, yeah, well, you tell stories, of course it's part of stand-up comedy.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, I think when wrestling fans hear stand-up, they picture me in a bow tie telling one-liners about the weather. Turning point for me, you said last time we really talked was 2004, but I saw you a couple of years ago in Montreal.
Right.
And when I went to Montreal, I was with a comic doing a double bill with an Australian comic named Brendan Burns.
Yeah, I know Brendan. Really, well, that's right. Oh, that remember.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He was like, he's a big P.T. Barnum. He's a big spectacle guy.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So I didn't know what that show was, but did you do that in Europe with him too?
Yeah, we did that. Brendan, I met Brendan. We did a guest set.
Yeah.
And I mean, he's razor sharp.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, one of the knocks on Brendan is he doesn't work. You know why? You know he's. Well, you're either with him or you're not. And but what he loved about working with me is he got to do his wrestling stuff.
Yeah.
You know, he was no longer doing social commentary.
Right.
About,
right.
You know,
right.
He was able to have fun and let loose. And when we get ready to do Montreal, we'd be doing our press and guys. And so you know, is it a wrestling show? And I go, well, I use wrestling as a jumping off point to explore greater. And he go, mate, it's a wrestling show. And I go, well, no, Brendan, I did. Mate, it's a wrestling show. And it wasn't until I went to Montreal, and we did good. We had good shows, Brendan and I. But I was walking around that hotel looking at one guy after another who was funnier than me. When I got like, it was like the reality check. Wait a second, you are the wrestling guy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You are. You're never going to be as funny as these guys. You might be if you put in 25 years.
Right.
But I was like, but I've got stories.
Yeah,
like Louis C.K. doesn't have a story about ending a match with his front tooth in his nose.
Yeah.
No, I do. Play to your strengths. And it was like, as soon as I got that and became comfortable with it, like the shows became better almost immediately.
You remind me of Rollins.
Really?
Yeah.
That's a good thing.
Yeah. Like, because, you know, you have a natural ability, you're a raconteur, and you can directly draw from amazing experiences and just keep talking.
Well, I was at a club, and it reminds me so much of the wrestling business because you absorb everything you can, and you're very respectful. Like, if one of the comics sees my show and has pointers, of course, you're respectful.
Someone's giving you pointers?
Oh, a lot of people. You know, Brendan's really taken me under his wing. You know, he'd write these long emails, you know, explaining why I might get a better laugh if I put more emphasis on the last syllable.
Was he right?
Usually.
Yeah.
You know, usually. And then he, like, I didn't have the heart to tell him, like, the one thing that he really built up had already been taken out of the show.
Uh-huh.
And so I'd have to include it when Brendan toured with me. So I didn't,
hurt his feelings.
Yeah. But I take what people tell me. Judah Friedlander was really helpful.
Did he tell you to talk more about poop?
No, but this is what Judah did for me. I'd kind of given up on comedy or storytelling because I was a bundle of nerves before I did it. Like, it was like I was going out for a pay-per-view. I was in front of 17 people.
You
in
were
Worcester.
More scared?
You know, when you're out of your comfort zone, especially when I was doing like the unbilled guest sets, you know, showing up at the club and, hey, can I do 10
minutes? It's hard, man, because a lot of comics are like, why is he fucking taking stage time up?
Yeah, yeah.
Why is the wrestler here?
Yeah.
I mean, I love him. I love Mankind, but it's a comedy club.
But they appreciated that I was there doing it for free.
Yeah.
To, you know, trying taking my out. Time, yeah. trying it out. But I basically abandoned hope. I'd given up on it.
Why, did you bomb?
I'd bombed a few times, not severely, but I'd.
How could
I wanted,
you tell? Because you were expecting
it.
Laughs.
I could feel it, and I'd had some good shows.
Yeah.
So I knew what a good show. I thought I knew what a good show could feel like, but the pivotal moment for me was when I told the Wounded Warriors that, I was going on a fundraiser with them at the Broadway Comedy Club in New York, and I told the guy I used to do some comedy, so if you want, you know. I'll do a set. And
the Wounded Warriors veterans?
Yeah. And I sat in the front table, and they had a, you know, New York, you know, the showcase night, so there's not a bad comic in the lot.
Right.
Everyone's doing like a really polished 8 to 10 minutes. Didn't know it at the time, but that's where I first saw Amy Schumer.
Right.
When I met her in Montreal, she was like, dude, I saw you, you know, and I remember her specifically pointing me out and saying I used to cock block her on Mondays because her boyfriend would be watching the show. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that.
Who, Jazz on the...
Not at that time. He's talking about late 1990s. Yeah. But Judah goes on, and of course Judah kills, and then they say, hey, we have a special guest. You know, you might know him from WWE, Mick Foley. And I proceeded to go up and just tank on a level I didn't think was possible. And I just, at one point, I just looked out of the crowd and I said, if I was in a pool, I would ask for a life preserver because I'm drowning up here. And it was like the most painful experience of my life, like worse than any wrestling match that tanked.
Yeah. You were the heel with no control.
It was, yeah, and you couldn't even like, didn't even have an outlet if you have a bad match. You have the physical pain, you know, it's kind of like, it lends a helping hand to the emotional hurt.
Yeah.
This is just like sheer, open, emotional heartbreak.
Yeah. Sorry, pal.
But Judah was there when I walked off. And I swear, like when I walked off the stage, I swore to myself, I'm never going up there again. Like, I don't ever want to revisit this moment again. And he was there and he goes, dude, it wasn't as bad as you thought. Dude, it was awful. He goes, dude, he goes, ordinarily, if someone goes 4 straight minutes without a single laugh, they're done.
Yeah.
He said, but people are actually listening to you. He goes, that's something other comics will never have. He goes, don't get me wrong, dude. You got to find a way to make this funny. And then, you know, so he started taking me under his wing and he'd call me up. I'd go into the city and we'd do like the 5 clubs in a night, you know?
Yeah.
And
Was he a wrestling fan?
He was a huge wrestling fan. I'm even on, like, I'm immortalized on 30 Rock because Judah's wearing the old school Mick Foley Cactus Jack shirt on the Christmas episode. And I had to sign like 12 forms, you know, just to give them access to it. But he definitely saved me. And then, you know, things started picking up a little bit, good enough to get to Montreal, good enough to, you know, do a little tour of Europe. And then there were guys like Brendan there. And it was, but really the key for me was realizing I've got a role. Like, I'm pushing, like, people are coming to the door and I'm slamming it shut on them, saying, no, I'm doing social commentary, you know. And then once I realized I'm the wrestling guy.
Yeah.
And also once I realized, like, from the other side that there is something to be said for just leaving people feeling good. Like, they can find other places to think deep thoughts. They don't need to do that at my show.
Do you talk about, like, the creation of, like, Cactus Jack and of Mankind?
I will.
And about, what, do you do a Q&A?
I do a Q&A, at the end of every show. We do about 20 minutes.
And what do people usually want to know? Are they usually wrestling fans?
Oh, yeah. Like, 95% of them are wrestling fans. But I get a lot of questions. One of the nice things is women will come up. And they'll specifically say, I had no idea what to expect. I'm not a wrestling fan. I really enjoyed your show.
Yeah.
And I said, thank you for it. I just, you know what? I saw Richard Lewis. Yeah. I imagine you know him over the years. As I got out of the hotel, I did Young Hollywood. And I saw him walking in. I just
today?
Rolled down my, yeah, just today. And I rolled down my window and I said, hey, Richard, I'm a big fan. And I don't think he knew who I was.
Right.
And I did say, my name is Mick Foley. I'm a wrestler. I do a one-man show. So I really appreciate and respect everything you've done. And he got this big smile. He says, thanks, man. You made me feel great.
Yeah.
And it was like, And I left. It was like a 20-second interaction. And I drove down the road, and like, I felt good.
Yeah.
And it was like, I don't know if he ever knows. Like, that was kind of a
cool
thing.
You made him feel good for a few minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's good. But when you, how long is the show when you do it?
I do about an hour, and then we go to the Q&A, and then I try to bring it home with a final story. And then my gimmick, you know, in wrestling speak, is I try to drop just one F-bomb a night and try to find a cool way to do it. So that if I do my, you're looking like cynically. Like, no,
I can't
no
stop saying fuck. Like if I, it'd be amazing if I could go, if I could do one a night, that'd be a miracle.
But you know what I was doing? And I think a lot of guys do this. And like, you know, some guys are like, you know, magical with the word, you know, and I don't put anyone who does it really well down. But I think for guys who are starting out, it's a crutch. It's almost like the big move in wrestling, like the steel chair to the head.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, you know, that does create a lot of drama and realism, but you're using it as a crutch because you know people can go, ooh.
I don't even think about it. I think I'm lazy. Like, I it's just part of the way I talk. And I don't know that people don't talk like that until I say it in a situation, like an office situation or like with regular people. I just throw fucks all over the place. And they're like, what is going on? And I'm like, I don't know. Doesn't everyone talk like this? I don't even think about it.
And most of the guys in the wrestling business do sprinkle their, you know, sentences liberally.
But when as a performing, when you perform stand-up as Mick Foley, I mean, what parts of the performing that you learned as a wrestler do you engage?
Well, you know, the comfort with the microphone.
Sure.
And I guess, you know, some of the
but
timing.
But are you distanced from yourself, though? Do you think you're doing, is the character of Mick Foley on stage doing Mick Foley something you have distance from?
No. I mean, it's kind of cool. I mean, I try to, you know, invite everybody in. I know it's a kind of cliche, you leave a piece of yourself on the stage.
Well, no, you're a pretty open-hearted guy.
Yeah.
I mean, but like when you did wrestling characters, I mean, you were very aware that, you know, this guy lived in this other world.
But over time, people felt like they knew me.
They did, because you've been around a while.
In a strange way, and there was a pivotal, like, series, it was supposed to be one interview, turned into a series of interviews, and in 1997, and this is at a time when you'd still go to like the local weather station and do the weather, news station, do the weather in character.
Sure.
You know, it was
a
different day. And yeah. If wrestlers were on like the Tonight Show, they were on in character. If I was on this show, it would seem ludicrous now to have
for
a wrestler
an hour?
Come in. It would seem.
Could you do an hour?
Oh, yeah. When I would do the infancy of the wrestling, they weren't podcasts then, but if you did website, yeah, you'd be in character at all times. It was like expected of
you. But for a one-on-one, for an hour?
Maybe.
Come on. You could do Mankind
Listen,
for an hour?
Mark, I did Cactus Jack for 6 months in Texas with my girlfriend. I had no way of letting her know that the guy she met was a character.
Really?
I did, and I didn't know how to break it to her, because she was attracted to that character.
You mean you
were
having sex as Cactus Jack?
I was. Indeed, I was. And you know what? And here's the funny thing. She started catching on, because I am, like, you know, I'm a nice guy.
Yeah.
And it wasn't that I wouldn't be mean to her. I was just, you know, a little out there as Cactus Jack.
Yeah.
And then I got a phone call. I remember her specifically saying to me, like, Jack. She called me Jack. Didn't know
oh
my name.
Oh, my God. And you just let
Jack,
it go
she
on.
She said, I know. And I said,
know what?
She says, I know. I said, what do you think you know? And she wouldn't say what she knew.
Yeah.
And a few days later, maybe a week, you know, a lot of time has passed. I got a phone call and she said, I need to talk to you. I said, can you tell me over the phone? She said, no, I need to talk to you in person. So in the drive over, I think I was 24. What else could it be, you know?
Right.
What else could it be?
She and found you out.
No, she...
Oh, you thought she was pregnant or something?
Yeah.
Oh.
And she needed to borrow $300.
Right.
And I said, oh, yeah, yeah. Not that I made a lot of money. That was about all I made in a week. But I said, I can lend you money. And later that night when it came that time, I said, I can't do it. And she said, why not? And I said, on my way over here, I promised God that if you weren't pregnant, I wouldn't have sex with you for a month. And she looked at me, she goes, you're kidding me. And I said, no, I'm not kidding. I was in character, you know. And she said, Jack, God doesn't make deals. I said, well, he made one with me. And she said, you know, I thought this crazy thing was just an act, but you really are out of your mind. Yeah, like it was that bond I had, the promise I made, you know.
It's complicated. Yeah. So she wasn't pregnant.
She was not.
Mm-hmm. She just needed money?
She needed a little bit of money. Just a little bit.
And Jack wouldn't fuck her.
No, not for a month. I think I caved in after 3 weeks.
Yeah. That's crazy. Oh, my God.
Well, that was the world I was living in at that time.
So what is your relationship with wrestling now? I know it sounds like you'd go back in and out and...
Yeah, you know, I was I got a call as I was heading for the premiere in L.A. asking me if I could be on Raw. That's the big Monday night show. And I was like, man, I had your show lined up on Tuesday. And so at one point, I actually was going to go from Los Angeles, and I had already gone from New York to Los Angeles on the red eye. Then I was catching red eye from Los Angeles to Kansas City, and I was going to take another red eye or early morning flight back, followed by a red eye back to New York just to do your podcast. And I said, I can't do it. Like, I can't do it. And honestly, when I had the one day off on this tour, and I was told Tommy Avalone, the director, I'd go out to L.A. on my one day off. He was able to contact you and get the show booked.
Sure.
And then I called him. I was like, Tommy, that's a lot of time. He's like, don't do this. You can't cancel on Marin twice. Like, you are correct. I cannot cancel.
Come on,
we're old
friends.
Twice. Yeah, I couldn't do it, man. Then I would be the boy who cried wolf.
But so what did you do? What did you do for Raw? I mean, what was the capacity?
Well, you know what? I'm, you know, kind of associated with this match known as Hell in a Cell. It took place in June of 1998.
Oh, yeah,
it's an annual tradition now. And they were giving two of the younger guys.
You did the first one?
I did the second one.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was kind of like the defining one as far as a lot of wrestling fans are concerned. And so they were given two of the younger guys, seasoned veterans, but young as far as the WWE,
right,
you know, in that company are concerned. And they were getting their shot. Their first real singles main event. And
yeah.
Mr. McMahon, who I used to refer to as Vince, thought that I might be able to add something to it. And so I got that call and brought in under a veil of secrecy. Like, I didn't even tell my kids, because usually I say, hey, make sure to watch Raw.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just wanted to see, like, if I could still, like, you know, if there was, like, the element of surprise was something special. And it turned out it was a good call, because my older kids were watching and they were like celebrating. It was a good appearance. You know,
surprised your kids on television?
Surprised my kids. And one of the difficulties I had was explaining to WWE that I was wearing Santa Claus themed attire for an entire year and would therefore have to wear something Santa Claus-esque even on Raw. And at that point, they were like, they just, you know, I think we want to get along. So I wore the Cactus Jacks, you know, classic red and black flannel vest, and I had a very nice Santa Claus button down underneath it. And we ended up using it as part of the promo, as
for the movie.
It. Yeah, no, yeah. I know I'm not out there to talk about the movie. Like,
right,
it's time to do business on the show. I don't want to distract from that. But the guy, Seth Rollins, did make an allusion to it, and then I was able to say, "Do you know why I, you know, wear this shirt?" So I cling to the last vestiges of my innocence, the ones that weren't torn away by this demonic structure. And so I was able to kind of get a little thing. I mean, people knew, and all of a sudden millions of people know, like, this is the 300th day in a row that he's wearing Santa Claus attire. So
you made a commitment to your fans?
Oh, man, yeah. Well, I made a commitment. I actually made a commitment to Morgan Spurlock when we met him in early April. You know, when
Why him?
Well, Tommy Avalone had always wanted this to be a Morgan Spurlock project.
Yeah.
And so we were having a chance to screen the movie, you know, not in its infancy, but at about the halfway point. No music, you know, it needed a lot of work. And we screened it for Morgan. The day after WrestleMania, I caught a 6 a.m. to New Orleans. It's just me, the director, Tommy Avalone, and Morgan Spurlock, like in his office, and we queue up this, you know, this movie, and you know, for 5 minutes he's kind of looking at it, and at about 5 minute mark he started tapping his heels, and I looked at Tommy and I was like, he knows we've got a movie, and knowing that, you know, promoting a documentary, you know, is always an uphill struggle. It's really a labor of love. That I just thought grassroots. I'll just start wearing Santa Claus stuff every day. So I did tell Morgan. I said, it was like day 97. I said, I'm pretty sure I've worn Santa Claus themed attire like every day. And I'm going to have this alternate Twitter site. If people are listening and my main Twitter site is at Real Mick Foley. The alternate one is at Foley is Santa.
Yeah.
And the only thing I do on that is document what I'm wearing every single day. So people go, there's only one tweet a day and it's what I'm wearing. And my daughter got a huge laugh because she knows, you know, my regular Twitter site does pretty well. And then I show her every week we go to the other site and see that I've lost 100 followers.
Oh, really?
And she's like, why? I was like, because there's just a lot of people like who like me but aren't along for the ride.
The Santa ride.
But now, you know, that we're getting into the season, I think they're going to...
It's a tough character for them adjust
here. Yeah, they accept it.
But it's interesting to me that, like, you know, when you got called up by Mr. McMahon, it almost seems that you lock into this weird, almost touching respect for the medium. You have a deep respect for wrestling.
I do.
And, you know, whatever's gone on, have you burned bridges?
Apparently not, you know.
Yeah.
I it seemed like I had at certain points.
Mm-hmm.
But even when I left this, I 8 or 9 months ago, I had the feeling I'd be back.
That's the weird thing is that, like, even if you burn bridges, I mean, I think that McMahon knows on some level, you know, the way that real life and wrestling actually sort of comes together is that if one of you guys is pissed off for as long as you want to be pissed off for, you know, the second that you want back in for whatever reason or he calls you up to do him a favor, then that just becomes a script. Your real life becomes a script.
I hadn't thought of it that way, but I believe you might have just psychoanalyzed me.
No, but
my entire life.
But you know what I'm saying?
Is that
whatever tension you're building for whatever genuine reasons you may have, if Punk is, like, I guess, turned his back on wrestling, but if you whatever you're going through, your return is going to be glorious.
It's all about forgiveness. I swear. I think there's a part in the wrestler's mind that needs the closure. And Mr. McMahon's like a father figure to a lot of us. You know, Punk may be the one guy, he may be the exception that proves the rule. He may be the guy who actually leaves and he told me he's never coming back. You know, I'd said that once upon a time.
Did you say, what are you going to do?
I did not, no, because I figure, you know, he's got plenty of things. He's writing a Thor comic, you know, and he's a newlywed. Like, he'll find something else. It's like, I get almost, seriously, on any given night, almost everything that I got out of wrestling, I get by performing in front of 150, 200 people, you know, and it's like, wow, I love it up there. And I'm sure he'll find something he loves.
Well, yeah,
too.
I mean, it's just interesting. Is there part of you that thinks, like, good for you?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, I'm pretty outspoken in saying, like, man, if you're Punk and you made your living because you were passionate about what you did, and that passion dies, then it's almost like you owe it to yourself and your fans, you know, to leave. Like, going back to Springsteen, my brother and I would argue because he was the original Springsteen fan.
Yeah.
I climbed on a couple of years later, and then my brother kind of hopped off, and he said that Bruce had sold out, and he was not playing with the band, and he didn't play the songs. I was like, John, if the guy's in his 50s and he's a multimillionaire, he's still writing songs about racing in the street, he's lying to himself and the public. He's like a different guy, you know? And so, I think that's something we have in common with musicians or comics is that they change as they get older.
You
can't be that angry young man anymore, or else it's just a facade.
Yeah, and an angry old man's not that appealing.
No, not at all. I remember I had this talk. Dee Snider was a neighbor of mine for many years, just moved out here to L.A., and I'll actually, this is the cool thing, one of the cool things about doing these one-man shows is like Peoria and Rosemont were booked around Dee Snider's Christmas play.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote a Twisted Christmas Tale. Very good. I saw it when he was like, when it was in infancy when they were playing it for Byers. You know, he and I support, what the other one is doing. And he said, like, he was out there after, you know, I Want to Rock and we're not going to take it, like floating in his pool, you know, at his beautiful house going, okay, time to write my next angry teen anthem. He's like, I can't do it. Too happy. And so.
Too happy.
Yeah. When I was, you know, late 80s, early 90s, a lot of my really good promo work, you know, microphone stuff was fueled by frustration. But it's, you know, it's hard to be that guy when you're 49 and you've done everything you've wanted to do. So you got.
What were you frustrated about?
Well, you know, I didn't have the look that WWE was, you know, that was in vogue. And to this, and this is something I found, I've actually started a story, started including in my show, was getting a nice reaction, is that I knew all along Mr. McMahon was not, like, he wasn't a big fan of my look. And it was only like 4 months ago at a wrestling fans convention in Galveston, Texas. Keep in mind that the Mankind character had about, you know, two-thirds of his face obscured by a hideous leather mask. And Bruce Pritchard was at the wrestling convention. He confirmed for me that it was finally a meeting in late 1995. Mr. McMahon slammed his fist down the table. He said, all right, damn it, I'll bring him in, but I'm covering up his face. You know, if I'd been offered that at the time, you know, when I met with him in 95, no. Like, he had another way of explaining why this was a great look for me. But it was really just one man's quest to cover up another man's face.
So that wasn't your idea?
No, I was really comfortable being who I had been, which was Cactus Jack, and traveling the country and the world. Like, it worked everywhere I went. I didn't see the need for a change. But as a lot of wrestling fans will know, you know, as I progressed, Mr. McMahon, to his credit, you know, came to understand, like, I had a more interesting life. Pretty interesting life story. He got that. And he also got that, you know, in addition to being Cactus Jack, I had this, like, kind of like fantasy, you know, role that I created for myself when I was 17 as Dude Love. You know, and he was like, cool. He was all the things that I wasn't in real life. And he decided to make that guy come to life on the screen. So, you know, with hindsight being 2020, you know, I'm really fortunate that I came into the company in 1996 as a different character.
Yeah.
Because I got to be Mankind, I got to be Cactus Jack, I got to be Dude Love, and over time just kind of metamorphosized into, you know, Mick Foley, where the fans, you know, will, with a few exceptions, always refer to me as Mick Foley and not Mankind.
That's, I guess that is an amazing testament to you as a person, that they're willing to do that. As like, because you were so many characters and they grew, you know, emotionally connected to all these different manifestations.
Yeah, yeah.
But when it all comes to pass, you were the guy that did that. And they're not running up to you going like, Dude Love or Cactus Jack. Yeah. It's like, Mick, what's up?
Exactly.
Thank you for your work.
Yes, they do.
Right.
And that's why I know Richard, that's essentially what I did to Richard Lewis.
Right.
And my kids will be with me, and someone will be approach me in the airport and say, just want to thank you for everything you've done. And then they'll walk away, and my son will go, you like when they do that, right? And I go, yeah, I do. Like, that's a little like a day maker.
Do you ever go, which one? Which one do you? what part are you talking about?
Occasionally.
Yeah, let's make it specific.
Occasionally. Because I was known for that, like I said, for that one match, the cell match. And for a
Is
while.
Is that the one where you hurt yourself?
That was one where I was pretty badly hurt.
You fell through the cage?
Yeah. That was a tough one. Because we were in a situation where, you know, we're the show business sport, you know, the fake sport. But we were also, at that time, in 1998, the only sport that continued when one of the participants was no longer conscious.
Yeah.
Now, that's changed, you know, with what we've learned about head injuries. If that were to ever happen again, that match would be called right away. And matches have been, you know, called due to injuries. And that's, like, the right move and the correct move. But if they'd called that match when I was unconscious, like, no one would have been talking about it for a month, because it was really a struggle to see how are they gonna finish this? This guy is out. So when people would come up to me like, that was the greatest match ever, I'd be like, that's like saying the Titanic was the greatest cruise.
You know, do you ever say, like, I missed most of it?
Oh, yeah, that wasn't great for me. It wasn't great for my wife. My kids are crying. Yeah, I remember calling home. I'd forgotten.
How old are your kids now?
About 22, 20. 13 and 11.
What are the older ones like doing?
You know, my son graduated college. He's still trying to find the right job. My daughter's kind of become like a personality, like on Twitter, you know, at Noel Foley. She's hosting a show for Ringside Collectibles. Very effervescent. And the biggest, this is like the, you know, the nicest things on the nicest things anyone's ever said to me list is when I took three of my kids to SummerSlam in Los Angeles. We went to Disneyland after the show for 3 or 4 days, and we flew my daughter's best friend out, you know, to be there. And 19 years old, like, how much time are most 19-year-olds going to want to spend with their dad and two younger brothers?
Yeah.
Like, none, right? Yeah. And we noticed that after 3 days, it was like, you know, they would go out for a few hours and come back, and I was like, no, you can leave for as long as you want. She's like, Dad, I really like hanging out with you. Like, you know, 19. I remember being in the Rain offices in D.C., and I had my daughter with me. And they said, oh, wow, she was 20 at that time. Oh, I can only imagine, you know, the headaches that she caused you. I said, no, we've never had a cross word. And they laughed. I went, no, we've never had a cross word. And then she came in and she verified. No, she and I have never had a cross word.
That's sweet.
Yeah.
And the wife's still on board?
Oh, yeah. She's
good.
Still
well,
there.
That's good.
She's still there. She allows me this Santa thing, you know? It's like there's worse things that a 49-year-old guy could be doing.
Yeah, you could be unconscious in a fucking cell match.
I think I need to show you. That's why I was digging for the phone. As you talk, I will bring up the image. It was a stunning.
Well, it's great to see you. I mean, despite whatever I may not know about wrestling, we always seem to have a fairly rich conversation.
We do. I think because when I met you, it was on the Air America show.
Yeah, yeah.
And at that time, I knew quite a bit.
Didn't we do a bit?
We did a lot of bits.
Didn't we do that one where we had Brendan play the conservative, yeah. right? And he won this. He was going to fight WrestleMe or something, and then we brought you in, and we did that whole script on the air, and then we cut the mics for years. No, people thought it was real.
Really?
We would get this mail, sort of like, "Hey, look, you know, they have a right to talk too. I don't agree with them, but I think what you did to that guy."
That's right. And I remember like just how talented the writers were on that show.
It was a blast,
you know,
dude.
When I came in and co-hosted for a week with you, you know, I was like, you know, 5 a.m. and yeah. here's the production meeting. These guys are just great. This is a moment. Talk about great moments. I'm on stage with my friends. Nora Jones has a project called Puss in Boots. Mm-hmm. She sings with Catherine Popper and Sasha Dobson. Great music. And I was their Santa for their Christmas show.
Yeah.
And they go to their final number and Nora Jones is singing Silent Night. And just in the back of my head, there's this voice going, if you don't walk up there and start singing with her as Santa, you will never forgive yourself. So here's the proof of that encounter.
Oh, my God. You did it. You look so Santa-y.
Like, I embody the spirit there.
So it's getting into character. You define the parameters of that character,
yeah.
and you just become it, and you feel that.
Sometimes, yeah, when it's really good. And you know when you're on stage and you're feeling it.
Yeah.
And there are other nights, Friday night late show,
sure,
and you're
sure,
just you're
like
working.
Get through.
Yeah, trying to get through it. trying to get through it. So it's like anything else. Some nights are better. Some experiences are better than others, but when it's really good, it feels like a Tori Amos hug.
Oh, well, I congratulate you on this new less risky role, this new less risky character.
I appreciate it, man.
It's great seeing you, man.
Thank you very much. And this is a big, it's a big credibility boost to be on here.
Oh,
so,
you're great. You're a good guy. I love talking to you.
I appreciate your time.
Yeah, man. All right, that's it. That was it. I love the man. He's been there for us. Mick goes back with me and Brendan to the Air America days. We've done some on mic wrestling shenanigans. I think we might have played that for you guys once. Go to WTF Pod for all your WTF Pod needs. I'm now going to play an out-of-tune Stratocaster for you because I actually got a little feedback. Said we missed your riffing. So I'm going to riff.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.